You're tuned to Current State on WKAR, your weekly radio magazine of the Capital Region's news and personalities and news from all across Michigan. I'm your host, Karel Vega, sitting in for Reginald Hardwick. The most iconic name in modern art history might well be that of Andy Warhol. Even casual observers of the art world know about his works depicting soup cans or celebrities like Marilyn Monroe. The Broad Art Museum on the MSU campus will be the site of an exhibition of works by Warhol starting this weekend. Andy Warhol, A Day in the Life, can be seen through May 6th. The exhibition was curated by Stephen Bridges of the Broad Art Museum. He tells WKAR Scott Pohl that it includes pieces from the museum's collection along with others that are on loan from other institutions.
Well, when I was looking through the collection, Scott, you know, it struck me both that there's amazing artworks in the collection, but I was surprised to find so many works by Andy Warhol. And I realized that there really was an interesting exhibition there. When I started to look deeper into what the holdings of the collection were, I realized that the Andy Warhol Foundation had given a number of significant gifts to the museum, let's say over the past 10 years, and I really wanted to pull those gifts together and do something special.
When people think Warhol, and yet perhaps aren't fully enveloped in the world of art, they think of the obvious, really super famous things like the soup can and the Marilyn Monroe. There will be a little of that here, but much more.
That's exactly right. There will be examples of his work across most media, including screen prints, film, photography, and really for me, one of the key driving interests is the photography, and that was one of the major gifts from the Warhol Foundation, was this trove of black and white photography and Polaroids by Warhol himself. And specifically, the black and white photography really drives home the point that I'm interested in for this exhibition, this concept that is built into the title, A Day in the Life, of kind of pulling back the veil on who Warhol was and a little bit about his everyday life, the things that he did, the places he went, and the people that he interacted with.
It's interesting to think about his approach to photography in those days and how modern day life, we're all sort of Andy Warhols. We're all documenting everything. Everyone posts photos of what they had for lunch or their cat or that sort of thing. He was doing that 50 years ago with Polaroids.
That's exactly right. And it's amazing to see that. And that's really what struck me upon looking through the collection and seeing those photographs was really, in a sense, how mundane they are. They are not glamorous photographs. They're not even well composed. They're truly actually diaristic. Warhol carried a camera with him beginning in the 70s pretty much everywhere he went and photographed pretty much everything he came across. And it's that insight into him as an individual that these photographs actually allow, and for that reason they're actually quite exciting.
When I look at his screen prints, I don't have the notion I could have done that. But when I look at his Polaroids that, as you say, are poorly framed, maybe, perhaps the focus isn't perfect, I could do that. I could do better than that. It makes me think that there is something there that brings people into the world of art. Not that the artist is always superior to their own skill set, but that their own skill set is, in a fashion, a form of art.
I think that's right. And, Warhol used a lot of mediums and a lot of art-making techniques that are quite relatable, that people are familiar with, especially now, especially photography. But the time that he was doing it, screen printing, photography, film, these were mediums that were largely undervalued by people in the art world. And he was, in a sense, kind of buking those trends and saying, no, this is the next wave. This is where things are really interesting. And this is where I can experiment. And, the ideal or the beauty of experimentation is that things don't always go perfectly, right? But that's the power of it, right? You try again. And throughout that process, and by actually revealing that process, I think that can be quite meaningful to audiences to see that.
Well, this exhibition exposes us to any great extent to his film work. And the reason I ask that is that people, again, are aware of his prints, for instance. They may even be aware that he made films. But if they know much of anything about his films, they may be aware of movies that are 13 hours of people sleeping, that kind of thing. What's the extent to which we'll see Warhol film here?
Yes, there are films in the exhibition, Scott. There are three screen tests, and the screen tests were short films that he made in his studio where he had people come in and sit for a camera in a very still, kind of very solemn or stoic kind of manner. In addition to those three screen tests that are in the exhibition, we're also planning a month of Warhol films in our projection gallery. So the month of May will be a series of films. I don't have that full list yet, but my hope is to show one film per week for the month of May. And those will include films like Sleep and other things like that.
Tell me about pieces that are on loan in this exhibition as opposed to those that are in the Broad Museum's collection.
Absolutely. I mean, to round out the display, I did go out and seek a number of loans. The three screen tests that I mentioned are from the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, and they were very generous in lending those works to us. There is a loan of a work, of a screen print, in support of presidential candidate McGovern in 1972, a screen print of Richard Nixon, his reelection campaign. And that comes from actually our board chair and collectors in Detroit, Alan and Rebecca Ross, which we're very thankful for. One other loan I'd like to mention is a loan from the Flint Institute of Art by a painting by Martin Hoffman. And the Flint Institute of Art also has a fantastic collection. And this painting is a portrait by Hoffman made at Warhol's bequest of Warhol in his studio space. And I included this work also to not because it's an image of Warhol, but it shows a relationship that Warhol had with other artists in New York at that time. And so you get to understand his larger cohort and the period and the peers in which he was a part of. I'm also planning to borrow a series of photographs from Billy Name, who is an artist associated with Warhol's factory. It was actually the factory, his studio space in New York, its first archivist. And Billy Name has a number of photographs that document Warhol at work, so I want to include those as well.
We're talking with Stephen Bridges, associate curator at the Broad Art Museum on the MSU campus, about the exhibition Andy Warhol, A Day in the Life. You've brought up the factory, and again, that's something a lot of people have heard about, the Warhol factory. I want to give you a moment to tell me about this space and how you are setting it up for this exhibition and how it relates to the Warhol factory.
Absolutely. So in thinking about, you know, the presentation of Warhol's work and specifically the screen prints and how to kind of make them pop off the wall, I did some research. And Warhol had a number of different factories, studio spaces that are all kind of collectively known as the factory in New York. But the first studio space is specifically known as the Silver Factory. And diehard Warhol fans will make that distinction. And that was because the entire interior of the studio space was covered in either silver paint or aluminum foil. The entire space was essentially made silver. And it was done by this artist, Billy Name, the artist I mentioned, who I'm also borrowing some photographs of his work. And so that, taking cue from that gesture of that studio space, I painted one wall in the gallery metallic silver to recall that space and recall that the place from which some of these artworks came.
I'm going to ask you a crass business question now, and that is that attendance statistics here at the Broad, at times, the notion has been we need to try to bring more people to visit the Broad Art Museum. Andy Warhol may be the easiest name for most of us to conjure when it comes to, I haven't been there in a while, I've got to go see that. Is there a crass business reason for bringing a Warhol exhibition here this year?
Not in that direct sense, Scott. Honestly, you know, I've been interested in doing this exhibition for the last year and a half. I've been here for 2 years, but it was my early rooting around the collection that pointed out these interests, you know, kind of solidified my interest in Warhol's work, doing something from the collection with his work. But certainly there is an interesting strategy there. I mean, he is, for better or worse, a household name, and probably one of the most iconic artists. But you'll notice that in my treatment of the exhibition, I'm not just putting on display his most iconic works or just following the kind of standard protocol of displaying Warhol. I'm trying to do something a little bit different and show something a little bit of the man behind the work. And so for that reason, I think not only will people, they may be attracted to come see the Warhol exhibition, but they might learn something a little bit more about who the artist is beyond the kind of more popular, larger narratives around his work and life.
One final question for you. Much of the exhibition planning for this year focuses on art that came from the 60s, Warhol being maybe the most prominent example of that, but other exhibitions that are planned for this year are looking back at the 60s. Why the 60s? Why this year here at the Broad?
That is a fantastic question, and I think one that myself and my colleagues will continue to ponder as the year continues. But I think there is, while there may not be a driving impetus, we may not have consciously said, okay, this year, 2018, we're going to look back, you know, at the 60s. There does seem to be something in the water, perhaps one might say, that there, this is a moment for reflection, for kind of inward, kind of a, you know, kind of a self-reflection, self-criticality, thinking about where we've been, how far we've come in the past 50 years, how far we haven't come in the past 50 years. And this seems like a ripe moment to do that.
The exhibition is Andy Warhol, A Day in the Life. You can see it at the MSU Broad Art Museum through May 6th. We've been talking with curator Stephen L. Bridges. He put this exhibition together. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, WKAR's Peter Worf showcases our new release of the month in classical music, and WKAR's Scott Pohl explores the world of velvet art. Don't touch that dial. This is Current State on WKAR. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Karel Vega. Monday on WKAR TV 23, you're invited to watch the film I Am Not Your Negro. The Oscar nominee for Best Documentary is billed as an examination of race in America through the words of author James Baldwin. WKAR's Reginald Hardwick talked with a Michigan State University professor who knew Baldwin. A warning, we included Baldwin using a term during this 3.5-minute story that some may find hard to listen to.
I knew I was black, of course. But I also knew I was smart. I didn't know how I would use my mind, or even if I could. But that was the only thing I had to use.
The oldest of 9 children, James Baldwin, grew up in New York's Harlem. A voracious appetite for books and experiences in segregation helped transform him into one of America's most prolific writers.
He had almost, to me, like a supernatural. He had a third eye, for whatever that means. You know what I mean? He had a sense.
Michigan State University sociology professor Carl Taylor was in grade school when he visited family in Harlem. It was not uncommon for Baldwin to be invited to his aunt's brownstone.
He was talking about social conditions, but he also was talking about how we interact with each other. He was talking about how we treat each other as family members. What I loved about it the most is that he could come like within inches of telling white America about its own hypocrisy.
For an example, we have this quote from Baldwin in the movie's trailer. It was taken from his appearance on the Dick Cavett Show.
But you know, when the Israelis pick up guns, or the Poles, or the Irish, or any white man in the world says, give me liberty or give me death, the entire white world applauds. When a black man says exactly the same thing, word for word, he is judged a criminal and treated like one, and everything possible is done to make an example of this bad nigger so there won't be any more like him.
In 1963, Baldwin's essays and push for civil rights landed him on the cover of Time magazine and many TV talk shows.
I don't know what most white people in this country feel, but I can only include what they feel from the state of their institutions. I don't know if white Christians hate Negroes or not, but I know that we have a Christian church which is white and a Christian church which is black. I know, as Malcolm X once put it, that the most segregated hour in American life is high noon on Sunday. I don't know if the real estate lobby has anything against black people, but I know the real estate lobbies keep me in the ghetto.
Taylor said, in the 1960s, African Americans were used to sports heroes or outspoken icons like Malcolm X pushing for societal change publicly. But when Baldwin spoke, it was different.
He wasn't Bill Russell or Muhammad Ali or Joe Lewis. Here was this brilliant writer, diminutive little guy who was gay, and in the way we think in this nation, gay was a minus, it wasn't a plus, and yet it was him. He became our David to me. He became our David and slayed Goliath with words.
So the movie is called I'm Not Your Negro. Right. What does that mean to you when in your interpretation?
I'm not, you know, what you're saying is I'm not that second class or third class person that you are trying to keep me contained to. And no one expressed that better to me. So when Baldwin says, I am not your Negro, that's about as far as you can take it without being actually profane, you know.
An intellectual way of challenging the dismissal, and that really spoke to the Black community.
It was a defining moment.
James Baldwin, a man whose words gave America a reflection of itself. Reginald Hardwick, WKAR News.
Its current state, WKAR 90.5 Classical kicks off a new feature for 2018. WKAR's new release of the month will showcase a new classical music recording highlighting a particular artist or group. The series debut centers around a globe-trotting pianist with a strong Michigan connection.
Michigan is a hotbed of classical music, especially when young superstar pianist Daniil Trifonov is concerned. This past March, he made his Montreal Symphony Orchestra debut on a University Musical Society Hill Auditorium concert in Ann Arbor. Then in October, he returned to Hill Auditorium for a solo recital, followed by a November live broadcast on WKAR with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra playing his own piano concerto. You can hear Daniil Trifonov's Rachmaninoff and Prokofiev Russian roots. He was born in Novgorod in 1991, started playing the piano at the age of five and wound up at the Cleveland Institute of Music. Trifonov was a prize winner at three of the most prestigious worldwide piano competitions, the Van Cliburn, the Rubinstein, and the Tchaikovsky competitions. Since then, Trifonov has been playing, well, everywhere, and in between concerts recording exclusively for Deutsche Grammophon. Trifonov's newest release is entitled Chopin Evocations, and the two-disc set, of course, features music of the Polish master, plus other composers' takes on the OG of the romantic piano. Leading off the set is the second piano concerto by Chopin, partnering with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, with a new orchestration by the conductor, Mikhail Pletnev. Other tracks include various masters' tributes to Chopin, Peter Tchaikovsky, Robert Schumann, and this Edvard Grieg's study, Homage to Chopin. Trifonov also includes two 20th century takes on Chopin's music, including American Samuel Barber's take on Chopin, set in the 1900s. Daniil Trifonov's Chopin Evocations is a brilliant take on the enormous impact of Chopin's music on the instrument and all of classical music. No additional Michigan appearances yet on the calendar, but Daniil Trifonov returns to North America in February for performances in Toronto, Princeton, New Jersey, and New York's Carnegie Hall, back to the U.S. in March for concerts in Boston and nearby Cleveland. Chopin Evocations is WKAR's new release of the month. I'm Peter Wharf.
This is Current State on WKAR. I'm Karel Viga. Earlier in the program, WKAR Scott Pohl explored the new exhibition of art by Andy Warhol at MSU's Broad Art Museum. Now he takes us to another local exhibition. The art world looks down on paintings on velvet. The images conjured by the phrase velvet art might be things like Children with Big Eyes or Elvis Presley. A Lansing art gallery is challenging the notion that this is lowbrow art. Casa de Rosado is hosting an exhibition called Black Velvet, a Rascuache aesthetic through February 3rd. Scott Pohl took a tour with owner Teresa Rosado and the exhibit's curator, Diana Rivera. Rosado starts by explaining what Rascuache means.
Rascuache is an aesthetic that a lot of Mexican painters used. It is defined by using what's discarded traditionally around you, but making something beautiful out of it. And the black velvet provided a medium different from canvas that would normally be used. And it created some surprising, beautiful results.
Well, let's take a look around. We're going to begin with what might be your biggest room of displays here.
This gallery is representing the landscape genre of black velvet, and this is probably our most diverse collection. It's landscapes are universal. We have in our collection pieces from San Diego and Michigan, desert scenes, and even I would call the Kincaid version of a landscape in here.
The pieces in this exhibition, are they new? Are they old? A combination of that? Do we have local artists reflected here?
We have local artists in the show. There's also an artist from Massachusetts that volunteered to provide a piece for this exhibit. What we have in the collection are pieces that were collected pretty much out of 10 states in the country, Canada, and going into Mexico specifically for our rooster one. The vintage, though, is probably like from the 30s up until 2018.
Let's go to another room. Teresa, you referred to this room as the icon room. Explain that.
The icon room has numerous pop icons, and also it leans towards faith, icons of faith that symbolize like the La Virgen de Guadalupe. And we also have a Christ that has a pink blood. So it's an unusual room in that we have caricatures as well as pop icons like Marilyn Monroe and Elvis.
And John Wayne.
John Wayne, too, yes, and an Indian chief.
And there's one more room we want to visit. Here we have a series of images that are also often associated with velvet artwork, animals and clowns, images of children.
Yes, we decided to pull together the things that were more recognizable in black velvet, the things that people kind of ridicule, the scary clown. I didn't get a scary clown, but I was able to find a happy clown, a unicorn that was donated to the collection, and then other things that are takeoffs on the black velvet, how it transformed or went on to become something like appliques on black velvet.
Teresa Rosado is the owner of Casa de Rosado on East Mount Hope Avenue in Lansing, where you can see Black Velvet, a Rascuache aesthetic, through February 3rd. Teresa, thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott. And if anybody would like to find more information on the gallery, they may stop by our Facebook page at Casa de Rosado.
We've also been talking with Diana Rivera of the MSU Libraries. She curated the exhibit. Thanks for your time.
And thank you for having us and thinking about having Black Velvet available again to the public.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
That's Current State for you today. We make the show here at the College of Communications, Arts, and Sciences at Michigan State University. The show is produced by Brooke Allen, Katie Cook, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Scott Pohl, Peter Worf, and our news director, Reginald Hardwick. WKAR's director of broadcasting is Susie Elkins. I've been your host, Karel Vega.